Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
This is Interpreter Radio, sponsored by LDSAgents.com. The Interpreter Foundation exists to encourage study of the gospel and faithfulness to the church by making the latest scholarship available in its journal, by publishing books, holding seminars, creating documentary films, and providing roundtable discussions of the scriptures. You can find us at interpreterfoundation.org, where you find all of our material, including these radio programs, which are posted as podcasts. You can also subscribe to this show in iTunes or through any of the other podcast apps on Apple or Android devices. And if you like this show, tell your friends and write about us, write a review about us on iTunes or your favorite site for podcast apps. That'll help spread the word and get us better ratings and more attention, and we can just keep growing.
So we could use more of each, right?
We always could.
Always.
Indeed. My name is Mark Johnson. I am hosting tonight's episode, and if you've listened to us this month, you're probably wondering, where is Martin Tanner? He's been here this whole month with all the other Interpreter Radio shows. Not to worry, he's here. Hello, Martin. It's good to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Definitely appreciate your expertise and your just your radio savoir-faire, something the rest of us are working on.
No, the rest of you have as much or more than I have, but you're kind.
Well, we will see. And we're also very lucky to have Professor Matthew Bowen with us from BYU Hawaii in studio with us instead of over the phone. Aloha, Matt.
Aloha.
Aloha. That's my favorite tradition of the show. And maybe I should find other favorite traditions because that one gets over with right at the very start of the show. It is really good, though. And we're thrilled to have you with us here in studio. So tonight, we are going to be talking to a special guest, Tyler Halverson. Dr. Tyler Halverson, he has written an article in the latest issue of Interpreter. It talks about the Book of Mormon and ancient Near Eastern covenant treaty patterns. We'll go ahead and get him on the phone right now.
He's on. You're all good.
We are on. All right, Brother Halverson, are you there? We're going to mash on a few more buttons here in the studio, see what happens. Well, while we're doing that, we also should announce that the Interpreter Foundation is going to be hosting some virtual firesides based on the life of Joseph Smith. And they're going to be called A Life Lived in Crescendo. And these virtual firesides are going to commemorate the martyrdom of the Prophet Joseph Smith and his brother Hiram. The first one is coming up on the 22nd in 2 days. So it's going to be given by R. Jean Adams, and I believe she will be discussing. Her presentation is called True to the End, the Culmination of the Earthly Ministry of the Prophet Joseph Smith in his Martyrdom at Carthage. Then we have additional presentations being given by interpreters on Dr. Jeffrey Bradshaw. Daniel Bachman is going to give a presentation on DNC 132 in a few months. We've also got presentations scheduled by Ronald K. Esplin, Joseph Bentley, and John W. Welch. So we've got quite a lineup of these virtual firesides coming up. So if you'd like to learn more about them, please see interpreterfoundation.org for more details. Okay. All right. Well, our technical difficulties are continuing to plague us, so we're going to go ahead and continue with our discussion of Dr. Halverson's paper. It is called The Origin and Purpose of the Book of Mormon Phrase, If You Keep My Commandments, You Shall Prosper in the Land. And it appeared in our last Friday's issue of the Interpreter Foundation Journal. It's online right now, and you can look at it for free at the Interpreter Foundation website. And in this article, Dr. Halverson discusses the phrase, if he shall keep my commandments, he shall prosper the land. And he notes that it may be mistaken as an almost trite way to say that it's good to obey God's commands, but there's more to it than that. And he looks at that phrase in an ancient Near Eastern context. And he describes this as being part of an old tradition of suzerain vassal treaties, which existed in the ancient Near East.
But it's initially a covenant that is that the Lord makes with Lehi, and it is it's like the Abrahamic covenant and Davidic covenants in a number of particulars.
So it really defines their worldview to a degree.
Yes.
Okay. So he discusses it as being a suzerain vassal treaty. For those listeners who might not know what a suzerain is, do you have a quick definition you can give for us?
Well, it's they're in a treaty covenant relationship. Generally speaking, there are sometimes covenants or treaties between equals. This is not one of those.
Okay.
In this type of covenant, there is a superior, and then there is a vassal, or the, I guess if you want to call it, the inferior party. When God makes covenants with his children, he is the suzerain, and we are the vassals.
Indeed we are. Very much so. Suzerain, is it a French word, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
Okay, so, and that refers to just anything from a king to an overlord of a city-state, or, you know, to God himself.
Yeah, the superior, your party in the relationship.
Okay, so he lists different steps and different parts of the Caesarian treaty pattern. It begins with an introduction, and then he uses Exodus 20 as his model for this. Moves into a historical review. It includes stipulations of the covenant, records a recording of the covenant, and depositing the text for posterity and for security, so they could refer back to this covenant in case any of the stipulations are broken. It has a list of witnesses, and it has cursings and blessings. If the blessings for if the covenant is obeyed and the stipulations are followed, and it has curses for those that might walk away from that or break that.
And you could look at this the way Taylor's described it here as being sort of meristic, meaning parts refer to the entirety of the covenant. Where you can't repeat the entire covenant over and over and over again, and so you have this nice formula, which expresses basically the basic terms under which Lehi and Nephi and then their successors are what they're obligated to do, and then there's the blessing and the curse. And one thing that's really interesting to me is the word for making a covenant, or the idiom in ancient Hebrew is karat brit, to cut a covenant. Well, in this formula in the covenant formula that Taylor has in focus here. The word for ye shall be, if ye keep my commandments, ye shall prosper in the land. But if ye keep not my commandments, ye shall be cut off from the presence of the Lord. That's the same verb, cut off, karat. And the idea of cutting a covenant is that what is done with the sacrificial animal in the making or cutting, concluding of the covenant, that is what happens to the party that violates the covenant. So the penalty here is being cut off, maybe not literally being cut down
in
the
half,
middle,
yeah,
but being cut off from the presence of the Lord. And that, as a Hebrew idiom, also involves that verb karat.
Interesting. So in the Old Testament, for instance, at times where they talk about, instance where they cut animals in half for their sacrifice, that's symbolic of them cutting a covenant.
And to bring this back to the Savior and to the gospel of Jesus Christ, it's notable for all of us that the Savior is the one who gets karat, or cut,
yes,
for all of our covenant violations. He is the, you know, that's the gist of Moroni 10, 32 and 33, that, you know, he's the one that it's the blood of the covenant that is shed, the covenant in the covenant of the Father. It's the Savior's blood that's shed for all of us.
He does it in proxy because we can't do it for ourselves.
Right.
Well, I have arranged to get Professor Halverson back on in a few weeks, so let's not dive too deeply into his subject matter here.
Fair enough.
Let's move over and talk a bit during the rest of our half hour here about the FAIR conference and some of the things that people might be able to expect. And for those who are listening, let's also mention that during our second hour, we're going to be talking about Come Follow Me lesson that's scheduled for August 30th through September 5th, which is DNC 94 through 97, the topic of which is For the Salvation of Zion. We're going to be talking a bit about building a house for the first presidency, building a house for printing of my scriptures. We'll talk about what that means. Temple, other things, a strange act that's a reference to Isaiah and a few other things. 97 has a reference to persecutions that are going on in Jackson County. So that's a little preview of next hour. This hour, let's talk about the FAIR conference. Most of our listeners will be familiar with the FAIR conference, but some may not be. They may be thinking a FAIR conference, well, this is like a conference of people from all over the world, and they come and learn how to put on a good fair for their state or county. It's not that. There's a little different context.
Now, FAIR, yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
Similar problems happened when you were doing farms. You know, they Jack Welch got agriculturally related emails for years and years with that. So let's start off with what FAIR is and what the conference is all about and when it is, because it's just around the corner.
It is. Now, FAIR, they've rebranded based on the recommendation of the first presidency for us not to use the word Mormon in our descriptions of our faith and us as a people. So they used to be called FAIR Mormon. They've changed their name now just to FAIR, which stands for Faithful Answers and Informed Responses, if I remember right. And one of their duties is, it's really similar to that of the Interpreter Foundation, we're kind of cousins of sorts, is to defend the gospel, to provide apologetics to the critics of the church, to, you know, provide these answers to, you know, these spurious claims that are made against the church, as well as to provide insights into new research in gospel topics. So, and every year they have a seminar where it's a week-ish of 3 days. 3 days where they'll have down in Provo, they'll put on this conference and everyone will gather together. They'll have presentations, get together for lunches and just mingle and
just have a great time and hear some wonderful scholarship. One of the neatest things about FAIR is their website. If you have a question about almost any gospel-related issue that's come up in your life, maybe you have some critic who said, what about this? And you don't know the answer to the question, go to FAIR's website and chances are they'll have multiple articles that will respond to the subject matter. So it's a great website, and it's a fun conference that they sponsor each year.
I'm looking forward to hearing about the proceedings. Is it, they're doing it virtual this year as well, aren't they?
The attendance is more limited than in years past because of social distance concerns. Mm-hmm. So I think that they sold 300 tickets or so.
Okay.
I'm not sure if there's anything left available for that, to be honest.
It'll be online, and
millions.
You will be able to watch it online virtually and read all the presentations in imagine the forthcoming weeks. So what are some of the presentations that we have listed up? We mentioned a few of those. We mentioned the Stephen Smoot ones.
Derek Sainsbury, who wrote a really interesting monograph recently on Joseph Smith's 1844 campaign for president, and where he examined those who were going out and electioneering for the prophet's candidacy. He's got another presentation that he's going to be presenting, I believe, on Thursday, and that presentation's entitled "We Mean to Elect Him: Electioneer Experiences During Joseph Smith's 1844 Presidential Campaign." His book, where he discusses that, it's based on his doctoral dissertation, is a great book.
I've been meaning to pick that one up. I actually have a relative who was one of these electioneers, one of the people sent out. And as far as I know, I hadn't known anything about that until we had had him on our show discussing his book a few months ago. And I was thrilled to learn that I had a relative there, my third, fourth great grandfather, Lucius Scovel. We did the Scovel Bakery there in Nauvoo. Proud to learn that he went and campaigned for the prophet.
I think we mentioned Kirk Magleby already.
Yes.
Right after him, Ryan Dolly is going to be giving a presentation on Evidence Central. If you haven't been on, it's another one of the websites that's from the Book of Mormon Central family. We've got Pearl of Great Price Central. We've got Doctrine and Covenant Central that we'll probably be talking a little bit more about today. The Evidence Central is excellent. It really pulls together the evidence for the authenticity of the Book of Mormon and, you know, really makes an excellent case, giving the best evidence, stating it very succinctly. And he'll be showing what they're doing with that, and that'll be a really worthwhile look, I think.
I do look forward to that. Everything that the team down there touches turns to gold. They've got a really good...
They really do have the Midas touch on that.
They really do. That's probably why they've rejected all my invitations for me to write Book of Habakkuk Central. Maybe it's an April Fool's Day item I can put something together for that.
There, you almost can't go wrong with these presentations with the presenters. Another one I'm looking forward to, a couple of them actually, really. Jenny Reeder, who's a friend of mine from way back in my Washington, D.C. days, is giving a presentation entitled First, The Life and Faith of Emma Smith. Jenny's just a fantastic scholar. She's definitely, you know, continuing her rise within the ranks of Latter-day Saint scholars. And if you know her personal story, she has just overcome so much in terms of the types of adversity, health-wise and other things that she's faced. And she's someone I admire very, very much. And so when she addresses a lot of these topics that she treats, she really does it with authenticity. She's really been there.
And it sounds like a lot of insight that she can bring to something
very
that
insightful.
wouldn't be there necessarily from someone else. So I believe I've seen her name in like a lot of the Sperry, Sydney Sperry volumes.
A lot of the scholarship that's come out on Latter-day Saint Women's Voices.
Oh.
Historically, she's bringing a lot of that to the forefront of our attention as a church. So, there's a lot of great work that she's done recently on that, like from the pulpit and some other.
Okay, yeah, that's one I have read. That's a very good book.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to hearing what she has to say about that.
And I believe Mike Ash has another book that's coming out. He's going to be talking about rethinking revelation and the human element in Scripture, the prophet's role as creative co-author. So this is going to be a look at that book that he has
okay.
coming out. So that title for this presentation is taken from the book that he has.
Okay, that should be a good presentation. I know that there's been a lot of authors and researchers who've explored the idea of Joseph's own participation and, you know, influence in the revelation. So it'd be interesting to see what he has to say about that.
And Keith Erickson has presented, I think, more than once recently, and he's giving a presentation called Real versus Rumor. For those who are interested in the issue of evolution and sort of the relationship of Scripture to evolution, Ben Spackman's done a lot of work in that area recently. He's delving a lot into just sort of the issue of evolution, how it's been treated in Latter-day Saint circles, you know, over the course of, I would say the last 150 years or so. He's giving a presentation entitled Through a Glass, Less Darkly, the 20th Century History of Genesis and Evolution. So if you're interested in those type of issues,
check it out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend his presentation. I've been a fan of his blog for some time, and he is very good at dealing with, you know, these issues of our interpretation of evolution versus Scripture and why they're always not always the best match for each other, and how just as you know, religionists and as scientists, we often find ourselves talking past each other instead of, you know, getting it together and coming together on, you know, equal terms and as well as terms that listening to what the other person has to say.
And Ben and others have pointed out that we bring a lot of assumptions to our reading of Scripture.
Yeah.
Sometimes that we're not even aware of, and it is always worth looking at what those assumptions are and, you know, being careful.
Yeah, Martin, you were talking during your last radio show with you and Van. You mentioned how you were thinking about discussing the New Testament church, and how if a modern time traveler would go back and attend church in Paul's day, you know, with the early saints there, you know, what would we find? You know, and I think, you know, perhaps naively, we think it's going to be the same, except, you know, it'll be the same church, but maybe with a Greek accent.
Yeah, instead of silver sacrament trays, they might be a little different, but they'd
a little more
have
ornate.
The Deseret emblem on them. You mm-hmm. know, no, and it, you know, it would be much different than that. We certainly know that it wouldn't be identical. And every single generation of the church has different assumptions, different beliefs, just from our culture that we bring with us to the table. And if you went back, I'm convinced, even to Joseph Smith's era, there would be many, many things that, of course, would be very, very similar, and the major doctrines would be the same. But many social beliefs and concepts, and even the norms of the way meetings are held, would be different. If you've read, for example, Rough Stone Rolling, you find some rather lively incidents in there where high councilmen, including Joseph and Hiram, get into fights that are more like wrestling matches than a discussion, and where people show up at a conference, you know, with guns and things of that nature. It culture and times were very, very different, so we need to keep that in mind. But the core of the gospel, I think, is very much the same, even if we sometimes have different models that we put our beliefs into.
Yeah, and that's always been a fascinating topic of mine, is looking at, you know, not only our assumptions that we're bringing to, you know, the table with our readings, but also, you know, can we, you know, perhaps excavate the way that, you know, the ancient, you know, listener, or the ancient Nephite would have understood Nephi's, you know, like sermons and writings, or Jacob's writings, you know, or, you know, how would have, you know, Abraham himself reacted to, you know, the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, and, You know, or even you know, Joseph Smith's day. You know, how did him and the early saints read the texts of the new revelations?
Right.
You know, how is that different than, you know, what our own experience and our own cultural connections would bring along with that?
The first time this really hit me hard was I just been back from my mission, and I, you know, saved all my pennies and went on one of these ultra cheap student tours to Europe. Mm. And I remember I hadn't been over there for very long when I was in London. And I ran into a couple of kids who were skateboarding. They're approximately my age at the time, you know, mm-hmm. just back from mission. And we struck up a conversation. And the stuff that they said that I understood, I was sure I didn't really fully grasp. And the things that I told them, sure they knew about 10% of. And I thought, in the same year, just across the Atlantic, culture and the use of language is so different that it made about half of what we were both saying as English speakers difficult to grasp. And you know, then you go back through a couple hundred years to, almost a couple hundred years to 1830 or so, and millennia to the Book of Mormon, the earliest Book of Mormon times, it would be difficult. One other thing I want to mention really quickly, and that is one of my favorite things that I'm looking forward to in the FAIR conference. And by the way, everybody who wants to watch this can do it virtually online. So go sign up. It's going to be fabulous. This is one of the times where you don't have to attend in person. But Jennifer Mackley has just done an incredible amount of research on Wilford Woodruff. As a matter of fact, her book that's out, I remember when I first picked this up and started to read it, I thought, why didn't I think of this? This is so, and I thought, because I'm not brilliant, but she is. But she goes through the history of kind of, I'll use the evolution word that you mm-hmm. threw out there earlier in a religious setting. She goes through the history of the evolutionary development of the understanding and meaning of the temple. How? By going through Wilford Woodruff's journals. And it's brilliant because the guy wrote all the time, virtually every day, mm-hmm. with only a few exceptions until the day before he died. And so he was a church leader and eventually a church president, and he had all of this great insight and information about development of the temple. So she's got this great book, and at the FAIR conference, she's going to talk about the Wilford Woodruff Papers Project, which I don't know much about, but I assume it's a little bit like the Joseph Smith Papers Project, except for Wilford Woodruff, even with all of his diaries, didn't write as much as Joseph Smith dictated. So that's another really fun one.
Yeah, that one jumped out at me, too, as... Wilford Woodruff, as you mentioned, wrote so much. A lot of what we know about certain parts of church history, we do know because he was such a diligent record keeper.
Yeah, he's the source of, you know, much of our information that we'd probably have a pretty big gap in church history if he didn't do his journal writing.
And Rebecca Clark's presentation looks really interesting to me. The Gospel of Equal Rights, Latter-day Saint Suffragists, 1870 through 1920. I think, you know, we probably don't appreciate just what a contribution Latter-day Saint women made to the suffrage movement. And so that ought to be really interesting for us.
It is. We have these gold dollars, Susan B. Anthony dollars, mm-hmm. which aren't used too much, but they're kind of cool. And, of course, they are dedicated to Susan B. Anthony, the great suffragette for getting, you know, of course, women the right to vote.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the little-known facts is that decades before she chained herself to the courthouse steps back there in New York, she came out several times on the railroad and met with the Relief Society in the Salt Lake Valley and kept talking to the Relief Society sisters and saying, now, how exactly is it that you're able to get all this power and the rights to vote? And how did you do this? And the truth is that among the very first places on the planet where women had full rights to vote were Utah and Wyoming, and it was all because of the influence of the Latter-day Saints. So your point, Matt, is a great one. It's underappreciated, you know. Gee, the Relief Society doesn't have a gold coin devoted to suffrage, women's suffrage and the right to vote, but Susan B. Anthony does.
And I know one of the presentations on the agenda, so going back to, I believe it's on Wednesday, Brittany Chapman Nash is going to give a talk called Let's Talk About Polygamy. And that might be one of the reasons why people look away from the Latter-day Saints and Latter-day Saint women during this time, because they make numerous unfounded assumptions about Latter-day Saint women during this period of time. So these presentations, I think, promise to be really enlightening and really edifying.
Yeah, I agree. And it's really impressive to think about the role of women in you know, the early church and how much, you know, they were empowered. You know, you can look at, you know, if you choose to take the cynical way of looking at things, a lot of the critics of the church do, is, you know, the women of being, you know, just brought into these harems and, you know, made as just young sister wives. But, you know, the fact is these were some of the brightest and, you know, most empowered women out there.
Most. Certainly not all, but most of the early women who were involved in polygamy within the church really liked it and believed it was empowering. Now, people today think, what? How could that possibly be? But what happened was women with children found that they actually had somebody they could trust to watch and teach their kids. And now they were freed up at a time when it took an extreme amount of work to do household chores, which were the purview of and requirement for women in those days.
Mm.
It allowed them to escape from those and devote time to all kinds of other things, because that Utah had the first women legislators and among the first women doctors and lawyers and people with college degrees, teachers, professors, and it was, in fact, because of polygamy, and of course, women's suffrage was also part of that.
And as a part of this conference near the end, we have both Brian Hales and Daniel Peterson, both. They present very regularly at the FAIR conference. I'm not quite sure what Brian's is about, but on the subject of polygamy, Brian Hales is probably the current leading scholar within the church on Joseph Smith's polygamy and polygamy of that period of time.
Yeah, he's been very prolific and produced a lot of very good research, very solid stuff.
And Daniel Peterson's presentation looks like it might have a focus, again, on the Book of Mormon Witnesses. That movie I have seen now twice, and I love it, and I enjoy it. I enjoyed it even more the second time. I'm looking forward to the third time, whenever that is. But I think I mentioned maybe last month that I think this is going to change the way that movies of this type dealing with Latter-day Saint history are made. This one doesn't pull punches.
No, it doesn't.
on the history. It presents some of the messiness that you get when you really dive into the history.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you walk away with a much greater appreciation for the contributions of the witnesses, in spite of the human frailties that all of those who were involved with the establishment of the church had. You really feel for them. It helps you really reflect on your own humanness and human frailty. But it made me love Martin Harris much more than I did before I saw that movie, and others too, like David Whitmer and Oliver Cowdery and their contributions. Yeah, you're grateful for these men and for the integrity that they had to the experiences that they had, and that they were true to the testimony, the divinely given testimonies that they had of the truth of the Book of Mormon, of the reality of the plates, and to the very end of their lives.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that I really got out of it as well. It was a beautiful movie. It was very well done. And, you know, it wasn't, at least it didn't look, you know, grand or over, you know, blown or just, it was a good, I don't want to call it a little film because it was, I'm sure, huge in production and very difficult to pull off. But it was just, you know, the end result was perfect's not the right word, but it was very good.
It's very good. And those movies, you know, when religious movies are made, the tendency is it's really easy for them to get mawkish or overly sentimental in terms of the way they're presenting, because you want so badly to convey the religious truth that you have a conviction of and understand, and try to get that into the hearts and the souls of those who will experience the movie. But this does not get mawkish. It doesn't get overly sentimental. At least I didn't think it.
No.
Did.
No, and I think that's one of its strengths, is that it took a very real look at, you know, these witnesses and their lives and experiences. It wasn't, you know, like you say, you know, flowery or overblown. It, you know, didn't cram anything down your throat, but it, you know, let you know on no uncertain terms that these men and women, you know, saw and they believed. And, you know, what a great message for us, and, you know, what a great way to reaffirm our own faith, and, you know, help us realize, oh, you know, look how hard it was for them, but they still persevered. They still stuck with it, and they stuck by their testimonies.
So if you haven't seen the movie yet, you better get on, not let the grass grow under your feet, because I'm not sure how much longer it's going to be in theaters. I noticed last week it was already starting to leave some of the local theaters here in Utah. Mm. But you'll want to see that in the theater if you can, if you haven't yet. And also you'll want to catch Dan Peterson's presentation then at the very end of the presentations on Friday afternoon.
Yeah. Now Dan, what does he do for interpreter again? Is he's involved in some way, isn't he? I'm trying to remember. Oh wait, he's the boss. He's the founder. If we had paychecks, he'd be the one to sign them.
Yeah, and it would be very difficult to underestimate just how much, not only he, but how much Debbie and he have both done for not only the Interpreter Foundation, but they're credited as executive producers for
of
this
movie,
film,
yeah.
for all of their efforts. And those efforts are considerable.
So if you are interested in going to the FAIR conference in person, you're out of luck, but online, virtually, you can absolutely, positively do that. It's coming right up Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, August 4th, 5th, and 6th. You can sign up by typing in fairlatterdaysaints.org, or I shouldn't say this, but Fair Mormon or Fair LDS, and you
it'll
know,
still
Google
get you there.
Mm-hmm. You there. But it really is just known as Fair now, and it's the 2021 Fair Conference. It will be absolutely spectacular, and I highly, highly recommend it. This is Interpreter Radio. We have in studio Mark Johnson, Professor Matt Bowen, and I'm Martin Tanner. We'll be right back with Come Follow Me on the other side of this break. Stay tuned.
Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
All right, we are back. You're listening to Interpreter Foundation Radio, sponsored by LDSAgents.com. If you are looking to buy or sell a home, especially in this market, and heaven sakes, I wouldn't want to do that by myself at all with the way things are today, please go to LDSAgents.com. They're a network of over 2,000 LDS agents, real estate agents. They will help you in selling or buying a new home. They'll help you find a new neighborhood, find a place where you feel comfortable, place where you can, you know, if you need a specialty school for a child with special needs abilities, or, you know, any other need, if you need a certain ward you need to be near or at, they can certainly help you there. They have a wide array of agents and years of experience. So go to their useful website to get more information. It's LDSAgents.com. Once again, LDSAgents.com. So this is the Interpreter Radio Show on KTalk Radio, 1640 AM. My name is Mark Johnson. I'm your host tonight. I am very fortunate to be in the studio with Martin Tanner. He's over there. He's waving. And as well as BYU professor Matthew Bowen. Aloha, Matt.
Aloha.
Aloha. I am so glad to have you guys with us tonight. And we're going to be discussing in this second segment of the Interpreter Radio Show the upcoming Come Follow Me lesson, which will be covering sections of the Doctrine and Covenants 94 through 97, and we've asked Matt if he could give us an introduction to these sections and tell us what to expect as we read them.
Yeah. One of the things that we should bear in mind just from the outset is that Doctrine and Covenants 94, it was in every edition prior to the 2013 edition of the Scriptures, it's been misdated. In fact, it should... Doctrine and Covenants section 94 was given on the same day as Doctrine and Covenants 97. And so really what we need to do in terms of discussing these sections right here is begin with Doctrine and Covenants section 95. And Doctrine and Covenants section 95 comes about 5 months or so after the revelation in Doctrine and Covenants 88, which pressed upon the Kirtland, the Latter-day Saints in Kirtland, the need to build a temple. And by this time, by June 1st, nothing really had happened on that. And so this is the revelation that's given from the Lord to the prophet Joseph Smith here. Really sort of tries to get that back center, front and center on their radar. Mm-hmm. The prophet, this is something that Steve Harper, if you go to Doctrine and Covenants Central, he has a lot of great introductions that he's written for this website and for for all of the sections. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that he noted was something that he noted that the prophet Joseph Smith seems to have been the only one member of the church really at this point who was really feeling the urgency of the need to build the temple. He'd written the Saints in Missouri about this, I think, a letter to William W. Phelps, where he talked about the importance of building the temple. But the Latter-day Saints in Kirtland and in Missouri have been slow to do this. And so that's one of the things that's going to be the theme that's going to overarch all four of these sections that will be under discussion today, is the importance of building the temple and matters pertaining thereto, like the law of consecration, mm-hmm. as being lived in Kirtland. But the issue of building the temple in Kirtland and when we get to Doctrine and Covenants 97, the Lord was, even as the saints are being driven out of Jackson County, he's still emphasizing the importance of building the temple.
Mm-hmm. Terrific. All right, so let's start then. Should we start with 95, as you mentioned?
Yeah, let's start with 95, and then we can cover 95, 96, and those sections that are really Kirtland-focused, and then go to 97, which is more Missouri-focused, and then maybe finish with, finish with 94, which is also Kirtland-focused, even though it was given the same day as the as Section 97.
Yeah, I think that is something that is easy to overlook, too, is the fact that the geography of, you know, these sections and the priorities, you know, of you know, what they're dealing with, you know, will shift from state to state.
And it's hard to keep straight. And it's important to bear in mind as we look at these sections, you know, try to figure out which saint, you know, which body of saints mm-hmm. sometimes is being addressed. Because that then you can dig more into the historical context, and that really helps flesh out some of these sections. If you're just reading this straight through with no historical context, a lot of what's said in these revelations will, not all of it will make sense. Some of it will, in fact, some things will seem kind of strange unless you're willing to look at the particular issue that's being dealt with.
Yeah, so it might appear that there's, you know, some flip-flopping. We've got, you know, a group that's doing really well and they're not doing well, but if we know that there are actually two different groups that the Lord is talking about, you know, then that could, you know, help us in our understanding and, you know, make it easier to have a correct understanding of these verses. So, Section 95, I think in the first verse, it really is one of the most powerful verses in the Doctrine and Covenants. It talks about how, where the Lord mentions this, you know, almost doctrinal declaration that, you know, he says that those whom I love, you know, I will chasten. And for my chastisement, I will prepare a way for the deliverance in all things out of temptation. And then I think is the kicker where he said, you know, and I read it with a pause almost. He says, and, you know, I have loved you. You know, we can therefore say, and therefore you're going to get chastised, which is exactly what happens.
And this is something the prophet himself knew something about and had experienced. You know, you watch the movie Witnesses, mm-hmm. and the way that it brings out that experience of the Lord chastening the prophet over the lost manuscript pages.
Mm-hmm. How you know the plates were taken from him and he lost the ability to translate.
So this is a pattern with which the prophet himself is familiar.
And I would imagine that'd be a pattern with all of us, hopefully the way the Lord deals with us. And I think that oftentimes it's easy to dwell on the idea that we're being chastened, and it's easy to overlook the idea that, you know, he loves us as well.
And apparently the sin here is not just some minor thing. It doesn't say it's a bad sin. It says it's a grievous sin. But it doesn't even just say it's a grievous sin. It says it's a very grievous mm-hmm. sin. So this is a big deal to the Lord. This is a major, major kind of a thing. And what is it? Well, haven't been serious about building the house of the Lord. And that's shows the significance of that, and well, here.
Gives it a lot of weight.
Yeah, in fact, I'm really drawn to this language in verse 6. And he uses that word grievous again, where he says, they who are not chosen have sinned a very grievous sin in that they are walking in darkness at noonday. And this idea that of walking in darkness comes up, it'll come up again in verse 12. Verse 11 and 12. In fact, this is sort of connected to what we were talking about with Dr. Halverson's article.
Oh, yes.
Verily I say unto you, it is my will that you should build a house. If you keep my commandments, you shall have power to build it. You almost hear echoes of the Lehitic covenant.
Mm-hmm. You shall prosper in the land.
If you keep not my commandments, the love of the Father shall not continue with you. Therefore you shall walk in darkness. That, to me, maybe describes what it means to be cut off from the presence of the Lord, as well as anything else in the scriptures that I'm aware of. This idea of walking in darkness because you don't have the temple and you don't have the blessings of the temple. And that's another thing that phrase, being cut off from the presence of the Lord, had reference to.
Mm.
Being cut off from the house of the Lord, the ritual presence of the Lord, and the place where the ordinances, those divine ordinances pertaining to the holy priesthood, are available.
Yeah, and just by way of contrast, skipping ahead just a little bit, going back to section 94, he says, talking about the temple, he says, if there shall be any unclean thing, you know, coming into it, my glory shall not be there, and my presence shall not come into it. And these terminologies, they're using the, you know, glory and presence. These are not, you know, things that are thrown around lightly in the scriptures. They have, you know, very significant meanings, you know, glory and presence. You know, these are temple-related themes.
That word kavod in Hebrew, when you go back into the writings of the Old Testament, it's an extremely important temple-connected word. As is the word panim, as it pertains to the Lord's presence.
Mm-hmm. That's glory and face.
There's a Jewish scholar that suggests any time you see the phrase before the Lord in the Old Testament, lifnei Adonai, which means literally to the face of Yahweh or Jehovah, we're dealing with some kind of temple situation. And that phrase, by the way, turns up a lot in the Book of Mormon and elsewhere.
But yeah, it does. And that's you know, I think the source of, you know, maybe the Lord's frustration with, you know, the saints not taking this command to build the temple, you know, them taking this, you know, command lightly, and you know.
Yeah, in fact, that's when they come into condemnation often for treating lightly or not taking seriously enough what the Lord is trying to give them. Mm-hmm. So you definitely sense the Lord who is patient, some of that patience wearing thin in these sections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for, you know, us, you know, modern readers, you know, us, you know, who are going through our Come Follow Me sections, it really, you know, hammers home the idea of not taking the temple for granted, you know, and utilizing the blessings. My wife and I were able to go to the temple this past Wednesday, you know, after, you know, a very long, you know, hiatus because of the shutdowns from COVID and everything. And it was just wonderful to be there again.
I've told my students that I will never, ever take for granted the opportunity to be in a person-to-person class, face-to-face class again, after we lost the opportunity to do that and had to do these online classes, which, frankly, for a teacher like me, they are not as enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
So I vowed that I would never take that the opportunity to have those classes for granted again, and I hope, as Latter-day Saints, I think that I've kind of felt the same way about the temple, that one of the great deprivations over the past year and a half or so has been the restriction from being able to attend the temple and be there in the house of the Lord. And mm-hmm. I don't ever want to take that privilege or opportunity for granted ever again.
No, me neither. And, you know, I've had definite experiences during the pandemic when, you know, we were doing home church, and when I've just had, you know, opportunities to meditate upon the endowment and the covenants that I've made in the temple. And I've had, you know, many experiences where, you know, the Lord has nudged me one way or the other, saying, you know, the blessings are still valid, you know, because you can't go, you know, that's, I've got this, you know, it's taken care of. But now that, you know, the restrictions are coming off, you know, I do feel the need to, you know, step up and do my part again. And it's just such an enjoyable and beautiful experience going back into the temple and being before the face of God.
It's interesting that the discussion you've centered on talks about the difference between something that's distant and actually something that's close, that you can see, that's personal, and how it's not quite the same, even with students, of being close and distant, although I can think of some students in a few classes I've been in that we would have always were a little more distant, but that's, you know, another hopefully story. Not the norm. And section 93 that was last week has this wonderful verse in it that talks about if you obey the commandments and if you don't sin, you can see my face. That's paraphrased, but mm-hmm. but the gist of it is that you can see my face and know that I am. That theme comes up many, many times, and it's important because seeing God is different from even having a revelation from God at a distance or him being inspired by him. There's something that's much, much different than that. And in section 94 that we're talking about today, you have a similar statement in verse 8 that talks about coming in there and his glory being there and his presence being there. It doesn't quite say see my face, but it says everything but. Mm-hmm. And then you go on, and it has this, and I'm skipping around a little bit here, but section 95 in verse 8 has one of these Doctrine and Covenants references to endowed with power from on high, which is sort of the earliest way that the endowment was referenced. Now everybody just calls it the endowment. Yeah. And I often think that if we use the full phrase that we'd get a little more of the import. And I often believe that it's no coincidence that all these verses come at about the same time, and that part of the endowment of power from on high is said very close in proximity to the time of being able to see God and being able to learn so much by this endowment, which, you know, if you know the truth and the truth will make you free, and if you learn things, then you have the power to know what's right and what isn't right, and you have the power to do things. And I believe that the endowment of power from on high involves learning, and specifically temple learning. That's mm-hmm. that's the logical conclusion here. So,
in fact, the repetition or reiteration of that expression, endowed with power from on high, you know, brings it back to this is language that the Lord has used previously, and it goes all the way back to the New Testament in terms of the power that was promised to the Christ's disciples mm-hmm. when you read in Luke 24. And it's really interesting to me that we, from the beginning, it's been the Lord's desire to endow those sent out on missions with power from on high. That's a big part of what the Lord wanted to do with the Kirtland Temple and making it a place where, you know, that there it would be a house of learning and preparation, learning those, you know, sacred temple truths. And today, we anytime we send a missionary out on a full-time mission, we one of the prerequisites, one of the things that has to happen before, almost in most cases, and I think today overwhelmingly so, that sister or elder has to have received their endowment in the temple. Why? Because they need to be endowed with power from on high in order to carry out the mission of testifying of Christ and inviting people to repent and live the doctrine of Christ.
Exactly, and I believe that that's, you know, you're exactly right. That's why, well, one of the reasons why, you know, the prophet was so eager to, you know, get the temple built was to reinforce, you know, the missionaries that were going out. There's a marvelous book by, his name is Carl Ricks Anderson. He's the brother of Richard Lloyd Anderson, who's, you know, one of the specialists, you know, late Richard Lloyd Anderson, specialist on the witnesses.
Yeah, the one to whom the film is dedicated. Mm-hmm. He's the witness to the witnesses.
He is, yeah. His brother is, you know, no slouch of a scholar himself. He has one of his books is called The Savior in Kirtland, and it's personal accounts of divine manifestations in Kirtland. It's a marvelous book, and I don't get any royalties, but, you know, go out and buy it. It's awesome. One of his chapters talks about how, you know, Christ will protect his people and his missionaries, and it gives, you know, examples, Matt, of these exact things you were talking about, you know, different encounters that, you know, the early saints and the early missionaries like Zebedee Coltrane and, you know, Sidney Rigdon and others have had, you know, in their preparation to go out and preach the gospel as they've left and as, you know, they've recently get their endowments and just you know, all during this time, how the adversary has stepped up his attacks on them. And the prophet Joseph Smith, you know, upon hearing of these attacks, was pleased because he knows that, you know, God is watching out for them, and he says these attacks confirm the reality of, you know, your divinely appointed mission.
Yeah, one of the things that strikes me too in these revelations, you know, the Lord makes these promises about Zion, you know, becoming fruitful and flourishing, but the Latter-day Saints then and now, we need to realize that Zion doesn't just flourish as on its own. It's not just something that the Lord promises and then we just sit back and wait for it to happen. I think the saints needed to understand that they're building the temple and they're doing it the Lord's way and receiving the blessings that he wanted to pour out on them his way was crucial for them then to be able to help the church get to where it needed to go. And, you know, we're still learning this. All of us, you know, we were talking about human frailty earlier. All of us have it. All of us are subject to it. We are. But the sooner we realize the importance of keeping the immediate commandments that the Lord's giving us, and the more we get the temple into our lives, the less we're going to walk in darkness, and the more Zion in our homes and then abroad is going to flourish.
Yeah, I agree, and you know that's one of the things that I really picked up again from, you know, my last temple visit. Was just the importance of having, you know, good feelings between, you know, everyone there, everyone who was participating, you know, that there were no unkind thoughts or unkind feelings between, you know, anyone there, you know, so we weren't distracted, you know, and so the spirit could be with us and not, you know, leave us alone in darkness. So, you know, these sections and these verses really provide a a good template and a good model for, you know, our own worship in our temples.
I just wanted to, before we leave section 95, I mm-hmm. wanted to just point out there's an interesting title given for the Lord in verse 7. He says, "And for this cause I gave unto you a commandment that you should call your solemn assembly, that your fastings and your mournings might come up into the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth, which is by interpretation the creator of the first day, the beginning and the end." Years ago I wrote a really long paper on just this verse and this title because it's caused so much confusion. Mm-hmm. I've heard people when they read this verse, they'll say the Lord of Sabbath. That is not the word Sabbath.
No.
That's a Hebrew word, Sabaoth, mm-hmm. which means hosts. This is a Anglicization of the Hebrew word Sabaoth, and it's kind of
like Yahweh would be.
Yeah, it's
an original older version of Jehovah, as we would.
Yeah, and
say.
A lot of scholars think that this is that Yahweh Sabaoth is the original longer form of a name. Frank Moore Cross, for example, mm-hmm. has written on this. What's interesting is if that's correct, the name Yahweh or Jehovah would mean something like he creates or he brings to pass,
mm-hmm.
he makes happen. And that connects the name Yahweh with the Hebrew verb Hayah, which means to be or to become.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting about it to me is that this title, the Lord of Sabaoth, or Yahweh Sabaoth, which is by interpretation the creator of the first day,
mm-hmm.
the name Jehovah, what the scholars think about the origin and meaning of that name are correct, then the name is connected with he creates, or he makes happen, or he brings to pass. It's actually... when we see that phrase come up again and again in the Book of Mormon,
mm-hmm.
And it came to pass, there the Hebrew term vayehi, and it came to pass,
mm-hmm.
Or vahaya, and it shall come to pass. Some scholars think that the when the Lord says in the Scriptures, "I am the Lord," he's saying in effect, "I am the one who makes it happen." And this often, that phrase comes after a threat or a promise of judgment. I'm going to make it. I am the Lord. I'm going to make it happen. So it's interesting that scholars like Margaret Barker have connected the hosts, Sabaoth, with the first day, actually, mm-hmm. of creation, the very beginning of creation. And then the phrase, the... on the end of that, the beginning and the end. So there's a lot there, and critics of the church and critics of the prophet Joseph Smith, who said that he just mistook this for
Sabbath.
Lord of Sabbath, and he was talking about Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
That is completely off the mark in terms of what this verse is talking about. So I think it's really interesting that the Lord gives this title and talks about himself as the creator of the first day, you know, connecting that name with Yahweh or Jehovah,
mm-hmm.
In the context of him reiterating the importance of building the temple and that there are good things that are going to be coming
mm-hmm.
if they do it, and there are going to be problems if they don't follow through.
Yeah. Yeah, and the temple is certainly a place where we learn about, you know, the first day.
A few verses earlier in verse 4, we have this reference that I briefly mentioned earlier, this strange act. Well, what's the strange act that's talked about in Isaiah? It's God's fighting against his own people. That's a little bit like that. You know, in a minor form, all those reminiscences that you wish you could forget of when you had a fight with your dad when you were a kid, you know, doesn't come out so well. He still loves you, but he's fighting with you if you're doing something wrong,
mm-hmm.
in effect. And that's the one of the references here, and you know, Matt, that's an action, a severe action that is being discussed here right before the verse that you're talking about, and so the inference to that, putting together what you said with what's been mentioned before, is you're messing up pretty bad. You're not doing what you're supposed to. You forgot what I commanded you. You haven't built my house yet, and as a result, I'm going to fight against you. And a few verses down in verse 7, like you're saying, and that doesn't mean metaphorically necessarily this is a real deal, because I have the power to create, and that's a real thing. That's not just some vague inference or something. So take this very, very seriously. That's sort of the implication of all of this in, you know, modern vernacular.
Yeah, well, I like that, and that's one of the things I'm trying to teach my kids as well, is just, you know, how to appreciate the power of prayer, you know, and because they're going to be talking to, you know, the one who created everything.
Yeah. In fact, sometimes we wonder, well, why are the creation accounts so important? We've got four of them, three of them in our canonized scriptures, mm-hmm. one in the creation account in the temple. Mm-hmm. One of the things that has occurred to me for a long time is, you know, after that in Genesis, you get the account of Abraham and the Abrahamic covenant and the promises made to Abraham. And then we see the Lord's ability to make them happen,
mm-hmm.
to make happen what he's promised. And I think that's what Martin's talking about here. This isn't just a rhetorical flourish in the revelation. This is a reminder of who the saints are dealing with here, who their God is.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one that's created it. He makes it happen. And it is a matter of spiritual life or death to either do and give heed to the commandments that he's given them, or they're going to, the love of the Father isn't going to continue with them, and they're going to continue to walk in darkness.
Yeah. One wonderful point. I've had discussions many times over the years with critics or even some members of the church looking at Genesis, for example, and saying, God, you know, I have a really hard time with this, because how do we get the earth created and, you know, the sun, and after that you get the stars, and, you know, how does all the order out of place here, you know, really work? And I think you've just missed the point. You've totally missed the point. Mm-hmm. That the Jews who wrote this, and I'm not going to get into a discussion of where Genesis came from, because that would be a topic for a different day and would take a long, long time. But the point is that those who created Genesis as we have it today had a different model than we have. There's no question. Their working model for the universe was different than ours, and it doesn't work the same way scientifically that ours does. The same way that Newtonian physics doesn't really work very well with particle physics, but it still served everyone just fine. It still does, mm-hmm. still does today. The point of Genesis isn't the order of things or what got created and what didn't and what later got, you know, destroyed in a flood. The point is, I'm who created everything, not just some stuff, not mm-hmm. just a little bit. I organized everything out of what's there. It's not a minor thing when you're talking to people who can hardly deal with some of the minor things in life in some little pinprick of time mm-hmm. in a small little location on earth. This is the power beyond all kings, power beyond all governments, power beyond everything, and it's difficult for people to grasp the significance of that, and yet that's who we're dealing with, and that's the point of this verse, I think, at least in a polite nudge, is mm-hmm. I'm really important, don't forget it, and build the house that I asked you to. This is one of the most important things you could do. Don't overlook it, or you'll be sorry.
Yeah. You'll be walking in darkness, as if it, you know, noonday, and I don't want that. I like the light. I like being, you know, in, I like being, you know, at least thinking that the Lord is mindful of me. You know, it helps me navigate being in the light, and helps me share that with my kids and my family and everyone else. So yeah, it's a big deal. You know, we need to take these verses and everything, you know, quite seriously.
As we move on to Doctrine and Covenants section 96, it's interesting. Stephen Harper made another great comment on this. He said
he's good, isn't he?
He is very good. He mentioned that this section, it's sort of like coming in on the middle of a really interesting conversation that you haven't been there for the first part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to, he recommends that as background for Section 96, Doctrine and Covenants 42, 72, 78, and 82, which talk about the law of consecration.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of what is this revelation has in view is the issue of land,
mm-hmm.
in particular what was known among the saints then as the French farm. Peter French was an early settler in the Kirtland area,
mm-hmm.
and this land was where they intended to build the temple. I think in the manual, the church manual for Come Follow Me for sections 94 through 97, one of the things they mention is Numbers chapter 2, verses 1 and 2 in the Old Testament, where Israel was to be oriented around mm-hmm. the temple,
mm-hmm.
and in the communities, the pioneer communities out here in Utah, you can see some of this notion carry over, that the temple sort of would be the, and Hugh Nibley talked a lot about this as well, where the temple could and should be sort of at the center of the community. Where I live and teach out in Laie, Hawaii, it's interesting because the temple was really the, yeah, I wouldn't say it's the first thing there,
mm-hmm.
but really it's at the center of everything that's now there in the community in terms of, you don't have the temple there because the university's there or because the PCC is there.
Oh, okay.
You have the university there and the PCC there because the temple is there, and then that kind of community of saints because the temple is there.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that we sort of, if not literally, orient ourselves to the temple, and that we're a temple-centric people that way, the idea is that we orient our lives toward it. And that's sort of a part of what's going on here in Section 96.
So just, he gives us the Lord's, or he's giving us, you know, his importance of the temple by making it the center, you know, kind of the center point on which we can all build around, and, you know, have everything be, you know, maybe even peripheral to that, you know, our farms and our jobs, but at the center of it all, you know, needs to be the temple.
And that's a common theme that the church and its members have forever after until now. When they got to Missouri, we still have the city map and the plot, and the center place is the temple, and the rest of it sort of goes out from that center spot. And, of course, the temple in Missouri isn't an ordinary temple. It's more like a temple complex with mm-hmm. different features than a temple today, but the temple in Nauvoo sits in a very prominent place. You may not call it the actual center of town, but it's in a very prominent place.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly in Salt Lake, of course, it was close to the center of the way Salt Lake City was laid out. Mm-hmm. It certainly isn't the center now. It even wasn't then, but it was in a very, very prominent location. And all of the locations for temples seem to be that way. The temple in Hawaii is like that, very prominent place where you aren't going to miss it for miles, in the Salt Lake Valley, the Jordan River Temple, the Draper Temple,
Ochre Mountain
is
sure.
Just way up there on the hill. They're in prominent places where they're not going to be forgotten, where life and other things can revolve around them, so one never forgets the purpose of the temple because it's not hidden.
No, exactly. And I think if, you know, maybe a critic might say, oh, they're just, you know, getting nice views and nice landscapes. But, you know, there's a purpose to that. We want our temples to be seen. You know, we want them to be, you know, lights unto the world. You know, we don't want them hidden in some canyon somewhere where you just can't get to it or can't see it. You know, we believe that these are the house of the Lord, and you know we're gonna show them off. We build them with the finest materials, and by golly, we're gonna make sure everyone sees them. And I appreciate that as a member who goes there.
Absolutely, the attitude towards the temple is such that we never will there be a time when somebody will go to the First Presidency and say, "Yeah, we got this really good budget deal on used material for." Mm-hmm. It's not going to happen. It will never happen. It's always the best of the best of the best, so that reverence to God is not forgotten.
No, and it does really show a dedication and the seriousness that, you know, the brethren and the church leaders have, you know, now. I certainly don't see us receiving the same kind of condemnation that, you know, was shown in early, you know, section of 95, or at least not on the subject of temples, at least. I'm sure that the Lord has plenty of other warnings and other things for us to be chastised with.
Yeah. And this is not some new odd way to build a temple that was devised by Joseph Smith and the Latter-day Saints. The early descriptions of the temple in Jerusalem were spectacular. This was one of the marvels of the ancient world. People described the glistening of the sun off from the walls of the temple as being blinding at times, and it was a spectacular structure that would definitely give someone pause and would make someone in the ancient world who maybe thought of other deity or didn't know much about the Jewish concept of God, they would say, wow, they take their God very seriously, and he is powerful.
And you want to talk about temples being built in a prominent place. The temple in Jerusalem was built on, you know, the rock where they believed that Abraham sacrificed Isaac. And this was, you know, a very, very important and very historic site for them.
Yeah, nearer to us in our times, you have. I lived when I was doing my graduate work out in Washington D.C. Near the Washington D.C. Temple, which I think will be open again this coming year. But they had it's in a very prominent spot as well. If you drive around the Beltway in D.C. and in fact you're coming towards Virginia from the Maryland side, and it just jumps right out at you. I think they actually had to turn down the lights on that.
I've heard that.
Years ago, because it really jumps out at you, and that's not always the desired phenomenon with people speeding out on an interstate. But I think this brings up an interesting word that comes up. We see it in Doctrine and Covenants 97:10, and then again in 94. You know, again, these revelations were received on the same day, on August 2nd, 1833. Mm-hmm. The Lord keeps referring to the pattern. Doctrine and Covenants 97:10, and I see it again in Doctrine and Covenants 94:2. And 94:12, the temple, and actually these other buildings that the Lord commands to be built for the work of the First Presidency and the work of the printing, that they were to be done according to a divine pattern.
Mm-hmm.
The word in Exodus chapter 25, verses 8 and 9, and I think in the last verse, I want to say that's verse 40 of chapter 25, there's this word, Hebrew word, tabnit, which comes from the root, from the same root that the ancient Israelites used to describe building.
Mm-hmm.
But they're talking about a divine design, that this had to be done the Lord's way. The tabernacle was built that way in Moses' time, that there was a divine logic to it, a divine pattern in mind. Mm-hmm. Solomon does the same thing later on. And I think Nephi had reference to this in 1 Nephi 18 when he talks about building the ship that the Lord commanded him to build.
Mm-hmm.
that was after the manner which the Lord showed to him, and not after the manner of men,
mm-hmm.
which makes sense when you consider what the function of the boat was, that most seagoing vessels at the beginning of the 6th century B.C. could not have transported Lehi and that whole clan mm-hmm. across oceans
mm-hmm.
to get them to the new world. And so, again, that's another lesson here, that the Lord wanted it done in order for the blessings to be what they needed to be for the saints. He had a pattern in mind, and he wanted the temple and the related buildings built in his way.
Yeah.
The Greek word is interesting, is typos, or type. It's where we get the word type. And that invites then, when you get into Hebrews 8:5 and the idea of the temple, it's not just a divine pattern in terms of architecture, but there are Christological types that point us to Jesus Christ.
Hmm.
When we start to break down the design of the temple, the ordinances of the temple, and we look at what they mean, it's all pointing us to Jesus Christ. Is everything typifies him
mm-hmm.
when we view it the right way.
So even the layout and the architecture,
all of it is pointing us to him as Lord and Creator. And
so all testifies back. One eternal round. It all comes
exactly.
All comes back around. There is a account that Frederick D. Williams gave when the pattern of the temple was shown. This is recorded by Truman O. Angel, who helped design diagram and plot the temple there at Kirtland, as well as design the Salt Lake Temple. So Truman O. Angel recorded this account based on Frederick Williams' narrative, and Frederick G. Williams was in the first presidency with Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon at the time. So these are Frederick G. Williams' words. He says, "Joseph received the word of the Lord for him to take his two counselors, Williams and Rigdon, and to come before the Lord, and he would show them the plan or model of the house of the Lord the house to be built. We went upon our knees and called upon the Lord, and the building appeared within viewing distance. I being the first to discover it, then all of us viewed it together. After we had taken a good look of the exterior, the building seemed to come right over us, and the makeup of this hall seemed to coincide with what I saw there to the minutiae." So they saw in vision how the temple needed to look. At first they saw it from a distance, they saw the exterior, and then they found themselves inside the temple. And then he mentions that, being in the hall there at the time, or in the temple, it matches the things they saw to the minutiae.
I think when in the Old Testament, when they use the word tabnit, mm-hmm. I think that's the kind of experience that the text wants us to understand, that Moses has, that Solomon has, and so forth.
With other structures like Nephi, building the boat, and perhaps Noah, according to some sources and legends, building the ark the same way, according to the same pattern.
And it's there in 1 Nephi 18 where Nephi says, I went into the mount oft and prayed unto the Lord oft, wherefore the Lord showed unto me mm. great things. So that implies a vision, that
yeah.
he's showing Nephi what it is visually.
And it needs to build, yeah, and what it needs to look like. And here we find Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon and Frederick G. Williams, you know, have the same experience. The Lord works the same way for them by showing them the finest details of what the temple needs to look like. And it was up to them to make sure it happened.
In our closing minutes here, I wanted to mention just a couple of things about Section 97. One is that it, I've often thought, is very much like the idea that reprove betimes with sharpness, and then afterwards show an excess of love, lest thee be esteemed to be an enemy. God does this here. The Lord does this here. He chastises the saints for not building his house, and then he even goes further, and in verse 6 gives us this very graphic metaphor where he says, you know, the axe is laid at the root of the tree. He says, I'm ready to chop here. All I got to do is, you know, back and down, and mm-hmm. that's it. You know, this is the 11th hour. You're right at the end. And he tells them that they haven't done all the things that he's wanted them to do. And this is about as harsh as it gets. This is pretty harsh language from God chastising them. But then, after he says all that, you go on to verse 15 and 16 and 17, and he tells them about how wonderful it will be if they actually listen and do this, and that they will be able to see him. And this to me is just a beautiful way of using both a stick and a carrot in conjunction mm-hmm. in the sixth verse, and then the carrots after, with great love attached to it. And I thought, you know, that is the most brilliant way to motivate somebody. You give them a little to worry about, and mm-hmm. then you give them a lot to anticipate, and then you tell them how much you love them. I mean, how much better could the blueprint for that be? I've just always loved this little section, even though it starts out sounding quite harsh.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that this comes on August 2nd, 1833, and just days previous to this, the saints in Jackson County, to whom this is directed, had mm-hmm. been forced to sign an agreement to leave Jackson County. And you know, distances being what they were back then, the scholars have wondered, well, could the prophet of Joseph Smith have even known about this?
Yeah.
I think a lot would suggest to you that he himself probably didn't know exactly what the plight of the saints was.
Yeah, I'm sure their cell phones were really primitive at the time. They probably couldn't text or anything like that. So,
but it's interesting because I think the Lord did have a sense of what their plight was. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think it's reflected in verse 21 when he expands the definition of Zion. The Lord understands that, you know, the saints at this time referred to Zion, they were thinking very geographically in terms of Jackson County and mm-hmm. Missouri. But it's sort of here that you get in these sections, it really starts to widen, the definition of Zion really starts to widen out. The Lord says, verily, verse 21, verily, thus saith the Lord, let Zion rejoice, for this is Zion, the pure in heart. Therefore, let Zion rejoice while all the wicked shall mourn. I think that would have been a real message of comfort to the saints who, you know, are being moved off their land
mm-hmm.
in Jackson County at the time. I know we're short on time. I did want to make sure we had some technical difficulties at the beginning of the show, but Steve Densley could not be with us tonight because of the passing of his father.
Mm-hmm.
We just wanted to let Steve know, if he's listening out there, that we love him and that our thoughts are with him and his family.
And our prayers as well.
And prayers as well. And they've been, you talk about Zion and families who have contributed to to the building up of the kingdom of God and the establishment of Zion and the Densley family there, you know, among the greats in that. So just wanted to say, make sure that he and Steve knew our thoughts and prayers.
Yeah, had our love. And then I'd like to invite any listeners who'd like to join in praying for the family to, you know, certainly join us as well. So it's been a pleasure. Brother and Matt and Martin, it's a real treat to be on the radio with you guys, and you know, let's do this again soon. Hopefully, we can get Steve with us. And Martin, it's always fun to, you know, be with you and, you know, see how you're doing and pick your brain on things.
Absolutely.
And it's Matt, it's always good to get your Hebrew insights and your keen eyes for, you know, these observations of these kind of, you know, linguistic things and other little delicious minutiae.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Martin.
You're now a seasoned expert on the board, and we'd like to thank LDSAgents.com for sponsoring tonight and the Interpreter Foundation for this show. And go sign up for FAIR. Go sign up for FAIR.
Go sign up. Go watch Witnesses.
Yeah, if you haven't seen Witnesses, make sure that you get a chance to get the theatrical experience with that. It's not to be missed.
Yeah, you won't regret it. Have a good night and a good week, everyone. We'll see you back next week for more Interpreter Radio.